So good morning, everybody. Welcome again to the final Friday. Bless you. Friday session. And this year we introduce, first of all, please get your hat, five-year hat if you've been here with us for 5 years. And today's the last chance to get it, so let me put that plug away. And then, let me also go ahead and make other announcements. So this is the final day, Friday, and we have this year introduced a new track. It's Crypto Policy and Ethics. Should be very interesting, and I'm looking forward to it. And the first keynote speaker, we have a first keynote speaker for the track. And this session, the first session after the keynote speaker, there's a break at 9:40, and then a second break at 11:20. Lunch is at 12:40. I don't think we have the other side room today. The exhibit hall is closed, so I think the lunch is all going to be up here up front. Although my note says the other way, but I think it's only going to be here. Once again, slides and audio presentation are going to be available later after the presentation and after the conference. And remember, we are going to do an audio recording. So when you have questions, please step up to the microphone and then ask the question. All right. So with that, let me introduce the speaker, the keynote speaker. I have the pleasure of introducing Mr. Matthew Green. Let me read his resume here. So he's a very impressive bio here. His topic is From Heartbleed to Juniper and Beyond. And Dr. Matthew Green, an internationally renowned cryptographer and security technologist, is an assistant professor of computer science at the Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute. Dr. Green's research team has exposed flaws in more than one-third of SSL TLS encrypted websites, as well as vulnerabilities in encryption technologies, including Apple iMessage. Sean is not here, right? ExxonMobil SpeedPass and automotive security systems, all these places, they've discovered vulnerabilities, right? Dr. Green is a member of the Technical Advisory Board for the Linux Foundation Core Infrastructure Initiative. This initiative was formed to address critical internet security concerns in the wake of Heartbleed. So welcome, Dr. Green.
So I have to confess, when I first heard that there was an international cryptographic module conference, I thought I was being spearfished, because I can't imagine that there's actually such a thing. But it's good to see that it's here and there's so many people interested in this. So today I'm going to be talking about a particular aspect of crypto that is not constructive. So when we think about building cryptographic modules, most of us think about algorithms. We think about, how do we certify modules? How do we validate things? I want to go in a different direction, and I want to talk about how we sabotage and break cryptography. Now, this used to be kind of a theoretical, question for academics to ponder about, but it's not so much anymore. And I want to convince you that, whether due to malice or maybe just very interesting bugs, a lot of the cryptography that we've been using is broken in some fairly fundamental ways. Let's see if this presentation works. Okay, quick, thank you for the introduction. My background is that I'm a professor of cryptography up at Johns Hopkins in the Homewood campus. I've been in information security for about 20 years in various capacities. A long time ago, I worked at AT&T Labs. I ran an independent company a few years back where I got to see some really horrifying things. I went through some FIPS evaluations of products. The research that I do now, though, I focus on, how do we apply cryptography? Really, it's kind of engineering-focused crypto. How do we look at real systems and solve real problems with crypto? And a second aspect, I think these are connected, is how do we build systems that are privacy-preserving? So one of the projects I've been involved in recently is making a private version of Bitcoin, which launched last year and is doing really well. So there are a lot of different problems I work on, but these are not the subject of this talk. Okay, one of the things I like to talk about when I talk to non-experts, which maybe this is not quite the right audience, is, you know, kind of why do we need to have these talks in general? So there's this very common kind of cliche that a lot of people put out there when they talk about software and system security. They say things like cryptography is not the area where we want to be trying to make things more secure. All of the problems occur in the software. Crypto is mostly a solved problem. It's, you know, the strongest link in the chain is my favorite quote. I was looking for some good quotes that really famous people used, but I found a couple basically centered around this idea. And what I want to get across to non-experts is that for the most part, these people are wrong. Yes, it is true that many of the really embarrassing things that happen in computer security do happen in the software chain outside of crypto. Unfortunately, the really interesting things happen in the crypto. If we look at the kind of stack of problems that you get when you build cryptographic systems and modules, it looks something like this. At the very top, you have algorithms and algorithm design. And I would like to say that we're pretty good at this particular aspect of it, thanks to peer-reviewed research and NIST competitions and so on. We've sort of solved this top problem. Unfortunately, beneath that, we have things like protocol design, which in 2017, for core internet protocols, we're still making mistakes on and finding huge, huge glaring bugs in. Below that, we have this even bigger problem of implementing those protocols, making things actually work. We're worse and worse as we go down. Things like designing libraries. I saw this great off-topic Microsoft function call that's part of the crypto API yesterday called Crypt Destroy Key. Now, of all the things this call could do, can you imagine what this call does not do on many versions of Windows?
Destroy.
It does not destroy the key. Okay, so we have a lot of work to do just in communicating with non-cryptographer developers, and we get worse and worse as we go down. And then finally, even if we do everything right, we have this problem of actually getting users to use cryptography right, to deliver keys and not just do stupid things. And there that's almost a unsolvable problem. Okay, so I drew these little stick figures to show, you know, kind of how things get worse as we go down. Okay, and even this algorithms problem, as we all know, is not a solved problem because there's an entire group over there meeting to talk about post-quantum crypto and flaws and different kinds of lightweight ciphers. So even there, we have work to do. Okay, the question is, why am I telling you the obvious? Why does this matter? Well, the answer is that it's caused a lot of really embarrassing security failures in the last few years. A few of these you recognize. I was involved in one or two of these, one called Logjam. I was involved peripherally in the Freak attack. These were like really fundamental vulnerabilities where something like 30% of the servers on the internet were broken, the TLS servers. There have been quite a few of these. They don't necessarily cost people a lot of money, but they could cost people a lot of money if somebody wanted to exploit them. The other reason we should probably care about this is because of slides like this one. This is one of my favorite slides from the Snowden leaks, and of course a bunch of people with clearances are now freaking out, probably. But this is my favorite slide because it has the following text. It says, cryptanalytic capabilities are now coming online. By the way, the title is Response to Improving Security, which I like. Vast amounts of encrypted internet data, which have up until now been discarded, are now exploitable, passively, presumably. What are we doing wrong? What is different between our understanding of how cryptography works and whatever it is the NSA is doing in GCHQ to make this kind of statement possible? Something is going on. We still don't completely understand what that is. Okay, so in this talk, what I want to focus on is the fact that our community has made enormous progress towards building secure cryptographic systems. We have validation, we have algorithms, and so on. All of this at the level of algorithm design, protocol, implementation, validation, deployment. But all of this progress is based on one key assumption, namely that the people who design and build these systems have our best interests at heart in every case. The question we should be asking is, well, what if they don't? What happens to us? And so I want to talk a little bit about that as we go forward. Okay, so back in the 1990s, 1996, a pair of researchers named Young and Young, not related, came up with this new term that they called kleptography. And they defined it as follows. It's the study of stealing cryptographic secrets securely and subliminally. They wrote a few papers about this. A couple of these papers are out here. They're academic papers. Most people didn't pay attention to it. And the people who did pay attention to it pretty much thought that they were lunatics because this is not going to happen. We don't have to worry about this sort of thing. It was a very small community of people with paranoid delusions who spent time thinking about this. But maybe we shouldn't be so paranoid, because there is a history of this in the U.S. government. So from the 1950s to the 1980s, as most of you know, there was a company called Crypto AG, a Swiss company, that built cipher machines, and their machines got more advanced. They were commercial cipher machines. And we know, thanks to a bunch of now declassified documents, that there was a long-term relationship between this company and the NSA, and that various changes, at least allegations, are various changes were made to these machines to enable decryption of foreign governments' encryption. And this has kind of gotten to the point where it's not really controversial anymore. It's pretty well understood. So those cipher machines, the things we were talking about there, these were commercial devices. So they were closed source. We had no idea what was going on inside of them. What's worrying is that we have this other slide, which is another slide that came out of the Snowden disclosures. I know the text is small, so I'll read you some of it. This describes a program called the SIGINT Enabling Program. SIGINT Enabling has a few goals. One of them is to insert vulnerabilities into commercial encryption systems, IT systems, networks, and endpoint communication devices used by targets. Another one at the bottom is to influence policies, standards, and specification for commercial public key technologies. And that's us. That's the people in this building right now. And the goal of this, and it's really important to understand the goal is to make these systems exploitable through SIGINT collection with foreknowledge of the modification. But to the consumer and other adversaries, however, the security of these devices remains intact. It's a very precise goal and difficult to achieve. How do we do it? Let's get past some of these. Okay, so the question we should be asking ourselves, and this part will get very slightly technical, but not terrifically, how do we build a kleptographic system, a system that a lot of people will use? So the bad news for us if we're trying to build a system like this is we can't go out and mandate some kind of closed source hardware. We're stuck. We have to use open source technologies, standards groups, and so on. In fact, we can't even build the protocols ourselves because somebody else already did that. We have things like IPsec, TLS, SSL, they already exist, so we can't change those. Maybe a little. We can change IPsec a little, but not too much. Okay, we can't mandate the software, because a lot of that is open source. We don't control who writes it. We can do two things. First of all, we can mandate the use of specific cryptographic algorithms. We have that power, at least if we're talking about programs that, you know, do cryptographic module validation. We can also validate implementations of cryptographic software. That gives us a little bit of power. So let's think about how we might use that. Okay, well, if we look at that set of requirements, it's very obvious that there is one perfect Achilles heel in cryptographic modules, and that is the random number generation subsystem. If we can compromise that, we can do an enormous amount of damage. And that's because protocols use incredible amounts of randomness. TLS uses something like 108 bytes of random number generator output across both sides for every single TLS connection you make, and that's just assuming you're using ECDH. If you use other options, it's even worse. The quality and the unpredictability of those bits, as we know, is incredibly important. An attacker who can predict that output can break almost any protocol that you build on top of it, with very few exceptions. And even worse, when we look at random number generators, they're used in the worst and most dangerous possible way. We have a single random number generator that's typically used to generate secret values, like secret keys and session keys, but is also used to generate public outputs like nonces that get sent over the protocol. And so we don't think about this. We just assume that our RNGs can handle this, and we just do it as part of our protocols. It's just what happens. But there are implications to this if your RNG doesn't live up to its promises. Okay, two quick things. If you're trying to compromise a random number generator, there are two different ways you can do it. You can focus on one of two different pieces. One piece is this low-level thing called the true random number generator. Sometimes that's hardware, sometimes it's entropy collection on your system. It's a probabilistic system that is very implementation-specific, involves hardware, it's complicated. You could try to compromise something down there, but the implementations are so diverse, it does not seem very easy to do that. The other place you could look at is the pseudo-random number generator, which is a deterministic algorithm that takes the output of that TRNG and post-processes it, typically to increase the amount of random data available to protocols, but also, at least if you look at the FIP standards, in part to whiten and condition the output of this TRNG in case it's not uniformly random. So we have these two different things. It's obvious that if we want to compromise a system, the one we can control, the one that's software, is this DRBG, deterministic random bit generator, this PRNG. So we look at that. What can we do? Okay, well, let's look inside of a DRBG and see what's going on inside of one of these things. This is just a very quick overview, and I'll skip over some parts. If you look inside the NIST standards for how these random number generators work, it consists of a diagram that looks something like this. There's an initial seed, which comes in from the true random number generator, and that goes through some function F, which processes it in some way, to get a new state, and then there's a new state and a new state at every iteration of the generator. Of course, you can't just output that state, because if you did, you could predict every future output of the generator. So we create another function, G, that takes those internal states and processes them into output data, which we then spit out as the output of our PRNG. So how do we backdoor one of these devices? Well, there are two different ways. Imagine that we, as the attacker, had some master key that could allow us to invert the function G, to go back from output randomness to the internal state of the generator. We would win every time, because once you get the internal state at time t, you know every future output of this generator. So that's one possibility. We have to make it magical, because if everyone knows it, then everyone can break it. So we have to know it somehow. The other way we could do this is imagine some kind of alternative translation process where we can go from a single output off diagonally, not back to the original state that created it, but to the output of the F function, the next state in the generator. Again, using some magical key that only we know. How do we do this? Well, I'm going to skip past some of the details of this just for time, but it turns out that in 1996, Young and Young proposed a way to do this. The way, the example they gave was based on Schnorr signatures, and they showed a way that you could use one Schnorr signature to basically build a backdoored system where once you get one signature, you can predict the output of every subsequent signature, and using that information, you can actually retrieve the secret key. But only to somebody who knows a trapdoor, not to everybody in the world. And it turns out if we take this system, which I'm going to mostly skip over the details of, and we apply this basic process over here into the context of a pseudo-random number generator, we end up with the perfect trapdoor. We take the internal state x, we process that into a value g raised to the x, and we apply a trapdoor, which is basically the relationship between a master key and this generator g. And this secret allows us to translate from g to the x all the way back up to that internal state over there. And so that gives us the result. Okay, so this, if you implement all of this in the elliptic curve setting and you add a few details, you get a random number generator called Dual EC DRBG, which was standardized by the NSA back in 2007. Using a handful of details with elliptic curves, and this was almost immediately found to be vulnerable to somebody who chose the parameters. This actual backdoor could exist. But of course, we don't know if the person who chose those parameters was malicious. It was chosen by the NSA, we don't know much about it. So if we want to think about dual EC DRBG as a backdoor, we're back into conspiracy theory land. We have no idea, are we thinking realistically about an actual vulnerability, or are we just being paranoid? Okay, so this is kind of where we get to here. Now, fast forward all the way to 2013, a bunch of leaks start to come out of the NSA thanks to Edward Snowden. And one of the leaks states the following. It states that classified NSA memos appear to confirm that the fatal weakness in this random number generator, which was discovered in 2007, was engineered by the National Security Agency. The NSA wrote the standard and aggressively pushed it on the international group, privately calling the effort a challenge in finesse. And you can find the whole article by Googling challenge in finesse. So we know that there is at least some evidence this was deliberate. But who cares? Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. We still have to take somebody's word for this. This is not going to hurt us. Most of you are not worried about the NSA spying on you. Maybe you are, but this should not be our number one concern. What should be a concern is that somebody else could use this technology against us. And that person might not be a US government agency. They might be somebody who wants to harm us. So fast forward to 2015, and we see the most remarkable disclosure from a company called Juniper. Juniper announces that during an internal code review, they discovered unauthorized code in their ScreenOS source code base that could allow a knowledgeable attacker to gain administrative access to NetScreen devices and to decrypt VPN connections. That seems really bad. Passively decrypt VPN connections. And this actually results in a CVE, CVE 7756, which states VPN decryption may allow a knowledgeable attacker who can monitor VPN traffic to decrypt that traffic. That's worrisome. We should be concerned about that. Let's zoom in on the specific changes that were made. Now, there was a vulnerable version, which is 6.30R20, And then Juniper patched this in a new version, which is R21. And amazingly, there are very few changes in these versions. The only really significant change is a change to this 32-byte value, which we don't know what that is, but it's a single 32-byte data value, not a piece of code. This is how they fixed this. What is that value? Well, it turns out if you look in the vicinity of that value, you find out that it's surrounded by a bunch of elliptic curve parameters. You see the elliptic curve order, you see the x-coordinate, and so on, of the p point. And so we have this, below that, we have in the bad version, we have one value. We have, in the fixed version, a different value for the 32-byte string. And if we assume, if we look closer, we see that these are the parameters for the dual EC DRBG generator. And what's really interesting about this is that NIST published its own value for that point, that master key in the dual EC generator, but neither of the good or bad Juniper versions uses that. It's really unusual. So we see two different versions. What's weird about this is when you look at the FIPS security policy for Juniper, you see no mention of dual EC. It's not used. But it turns out there is a note that says dual EC is used in some versions of the generator. ScreenOS uses it in a way that uses it to seed another triple DES or AES-based generator, ANSI X9.31. So we're using it kind of to generate seeding material. Now, many of you know this story, so I won't spend too much time on it. But if you look at what's going on inside of a Juniper device, you see a diagram something like this. You see some kind of seed material coming in from the operating system. You see that going into the dual EC generator, which allegedly or was not apparently used according to the security policy. And then you see the output of that dual EC generator going in as seeding to the ANSI X9.31 DES generator. Now, what we know about this design is that the post-processing with the triple DES generator should wipe out any known backdoor in the dual EC system, because the post-processing should make it impossible for us to recover. Of course, when you look at the code, you see the following. And I want to just walk through quickly. So this is the actual code that generates output from PRNG generate. The very first thing that happens is we make a subroutine call to this function called PRNG reseed. And that's all the way up at the top. Okay? So we do that call first. Below that, after we've gotten output, which comes from dual EC, we go through a loop. And the loop is the loop that does the post-processing with the ANSI X9.31 generator. So we do this there. Okay, so we run this in place. Something you may not be able to see from all the way in the back of the room, but when you look at this loop, the loop index is this variable called PRNG output index. This is not a local variable, it's a global. Now, how many of you who have written a lot of C code use global variables for your loops? Not a very common thing, although you can imagine, well, yeah, okay, Dan might do it, I don't know. But you can imagine this is something that could happen. I would love to see what the original code looks like, because it could just be a typo or a deliberate typo that somebody put into the code using the wrong variable. But roughly speaking, what happens is that the index is initialized up here at line 15. We make a subroutine call, and then we perform this loop that should do the post-processing. However, if you look at the very last line of code in the PRNG reseed function, it takes that global variable and sets it to 32. And the end result of that is this final loop, the stuff in the red box, never executes. And that means ANSI never happens. We never process the output of dual EC. The output of dual EC is in a buffer in place, and it goes out raw, potentially out on the wire. Okay, so this is basically the flow of things. So the end result, what we actually get in the real deployed system, is this, just dual EC output going out to the world. And that allows a recovery attack. Now, we can actually exploit this. So we implemented an exploit that actually goes and takes a real NetScreen device and tries to recover things. There are some really interesting details in this. It turns out there were a lot of engineering decisions that were made in tandem with the addition of dual EC into Juniper's code. One of those is that if you look at the Internet Key Exchange Protocol, which is the key agreement protocol for IPsec, in the earlier versions of ScreenOS that precede dual EC, the nonces that are used in the protocol are 20 bytes long. If NetScreen had kept 20 byte nonces, that would not have been enough output to actually perform the attack on dual EC that allows you to recover internal state. You need about 28 bytes at a minimum. Anything less will not work. So coincidentally, when Juniper deployed dual EC, this is back in 2008 or so, they increased the nonce size to 32 bytes, which is exactly as long as they need to be to make the dual EC attack work. Okay, that's possibly something that's interesting. Okay? Another thing that happens, if you look at the ordering of the way things work, if you want the dual EC attack to work correctly, you want the first thing that happens to be the generation of a nonce, and you want the second thing to happen to be the generation of the Diffie-Hellman ephemeral secret key for that connection. And the idea is that from this nonce, you can recover the generator state, and that will allow you to predict what the Diffie-Hellman internal secret key used by a device is. This is the flow that you want in the attack. Once the attacker sees this nonce, they can recompute the Diffie-Hellman secret key. But NetScreen, Juniper NetScreen, does not actually implement that flow. If you look at the naive description of how the code works, it appears to do things in the opposite order. The very first thing it does is it generates a Diffie-Hellman secret key, and only after that does it generate the nonce. This still might allow an attack across sessions, where if you recover the generator state here, you could predict the next secret key in the next session, but it does seem to rule out the possibility of a very simple eavesdropping on one session attack. When you look a little closer, though, you find that in the same edition of ScreenOS, version 6.2 that introduced dual EC, you find this new data structure called a nonce pre-generation queue. And while it appears that nonces are generated after Diffie-Hellman secret keys, the fact that this nonce pre-generation queue exists ensures that in practice the nonce will always be generated right before the Diffie-Hellman secret key, even though the apparent flow of the code does not give that. So this reactivates the attack, but it does it in a very circuitous way where code inspection would make it appear that this is not possible. So we know that these things are in the code. We did an analysis and we showed that the exploits are very fast. So I want to show a timeline just to show you exactly what's going on in the world here. Okay, so back in 1996, we had the invention of these setups by Young and Young. In 98, we see probably the beginning of dual EC development. In 2004, we see NIST and ANSI standardization begin. In 2007, we have this final standard. So this is kind of the beginning. Let's look over on the right side. So almost immediately after the standardization, Juniper added dual EC to their system. About 4 years later, the ScreenOS, the Juniper code, was hacked. So this is when the attackers made a change that allowed them to change the master parameter of the dual EC system to allow recovery. And about 3 whole years later, we have the discovery of the hack and the removal of this malicious code. So this code was, this hack was active for a long period of time. You can see that. This is really when it was, the orange part is when dual EC was present and potentially exploitable by Juniper. The red part is when the hackers went in and changed the dual EC parameters to make it exploitable by them. Very long period of time in either case. Okay, so again, do we know whether that orange part was malicious on Juniper's part? No. We have to kind of look at the code and make our best guesses, and maybe we're just being nuts if we think about that. But it is worrisome that a major manufacturer of VPN devices had this vulnerability present for so long. So the question I want to ask as I kind of wrap up this part is, let's assume for the moment that these dual EC DRBGs flaws were deliberate and not an accident. And let's assume, moreover, and we don't really have to assume because we saw the slides, but let's assume that there was a government policy to promote the existence of passive decryption vulnerabilities in VPN devices. How would you do that before dual EC came along? Well, what's the most popular random number generator in existence before dual EC? It's this thing called ANSI X9.31, which we already saw. There's a well-known vulnerability in ANSI X9.31 where if you use the same K for all of your devices, there are two seeding inputs, there's a K and an S. If you use a fixed K across the device implementation and never change it, even if you pick a random S, you can actually invert and you can recover the generator state and attack these systems. Okay, so there is this well-known attack, the standard says nothing about it, and if you don't know K, it looks like a perfectly working random number generator. If you start going through the FIPS and common criteria security policies, you find things like this that should be really worrying to a cryptographer. The hard-coded keys in this device are ANSI X9.31 RNG AES key. What this means is if I can get the code for this device, I can extract this key and I can recover all random numbers, I can recover the state of the random number generator for anything this device does. This device happens to be a Fortinet FortiGate 200B device running FortiOS version 4. So if we know this key, we can attack these devices. So let's look and see if we can do that. So along with Nadia Henninger and one of her grad students, Shannon Coney, we looked to see if we could attack Fortinet devices using this vulnerability. And what we found was that we actually could do it. Using about 2 to the 40 or 2 to the 50 operations, we can passively decrypt any VPN connection made by these devices. Okay, so this is not something I want to dwell on because it's, you know, just it seems like a simple bug. But let's try to sum up what we've discovered here. In the same period of time, about 2012 to 2015, we have catastrophic and perhaps, at least in one case, possibly deliberate vulnerabilities in the random number generation subsystem of two leading VPN device manufacturers. Okay, there are two ways you can look at this. Now, I don't want to be the person with the UFOs, but one way to look at this is never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. So maybe people made mistakes. On the other hand, we could also say we shouldn't attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity, but we shouldn't rule out malice. So maybe there are people trying to break our systems, and maybe we should think about that. Okay, so how do we fix this? The thing that I wanted to get to, and since this is a cryptographic module conference, there are a lot of ethical questions here about, you know, the government doing all of the things they kind of admitted to doing on those slides. But, you know, the basic problem here is that if the government is going to do these things, there's very little that we can do about them. So if we trust random number generators, we're kind of in big trouble. So we could try to build more resilient protocols. That helps a little bit, but it doesn't help very much. In fact, it turns out that the direction we've been going is building protocols that are less resilient to this kind of random number generator compromise. And I won't go into the details because I don't have time. The thing that I want to focus on is that maybe our enemy here is not so much the protocol design, but maybe our enemy here is the way we validate cryptographic modules. We have this antiquated system that relies on testing modules and evaluating a whole bunch of paper before we accept them to be valid. It's possible that this system is actually what's hurting us. And we know this because FortiGate, which has this critical RNG vulnerability, had a document on a public website that anyone competent who had reviewed this cryptographically should have known meant that all of their systems were vulnerable to trivial passive decryption attacks. So the system isn't working. Maybe we need to fix that and remove FIPS validation, reimagine how we do validation of cryptographic modules to get rid of these problems. And even worse, and I just want to dwell on one last detail before they throw me off the stage, the FortiOS hard-coded key, the one that was in all of these FortiGate devices, was actually a testing key. Why is a testing key hard-coded into these devices? Well, the answer is that there are mandatory runtime tests that the FIPS validation standards require you to run. It's much easier to bake that key into the system. And if the key goes into production, oops, that's too bad. Well, nobody will notice except possibly government agencies who want to break this traffic. Okay, now I want to skip over a couple of the other things. Maybe the future is that we try to build systems that can be resilient to this. And I have a lot of kind of research around this area that I want to do, but I'm not going to spend too much time on it because we don't have a lot of time. I just do want to mention that the academic cryptography community is moving very expeditiously in the direction of trying to find ways to limit these attacks. It's an almost insoluble problem, which is why, of course, academics like it so much. But the real question we should be asking is how can we as the design and implementation community start deploying and building systems that are resilient to this? And as Americans, what should we be saying to the government when we learn that they have programs that are designed to compromise cryptographic devices? And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting, Dr. Green. Are there any questions?
Sorry, Matt. I'm actually really curious if there has been anything published about what kind of forensic examination Juniper did to figure out how the code was inserted. And specifically, you know, you mentioned these other design changes that happened at the same time. Mm-hmm. Those aren't attributed to being hacks, right?
Yes, sorry. To be clear, so the design changes were made by Juniper. Everything,
right.
The inclusion of Dual EC, the inclusion of these design changes was all done by Juniper. They were hacked in 2012, and the only change that was made there was the change of the master key.
Right.
Sorry, that was very fast.
So I'm just curious if there's, you know, if there's been anything published about what they've investigated, right? Obviously, if they're complicit, and I'm assuming that there is a, you know, that they're complicit, then of course they probably wouldn't look too deeply, but it seems like if it were my company and I'd found out something like this had happened, I would be doing, what kind of forensic evidence can I come up with to see if there was collusion between engineers or if it was just this strange, coincidence? I was just curious if there's been any information on that.
So there is possibly ongoing FBI investigation, and nobody has commented. It may be over at this point. Nobody has commented. I've asked people I know who are Senate staffers, and nobody in the Senate is talking about it. It just kind of disappeared into a black hole. The only rumor I heard was that there was some evidence of collusion with a foreign national who might have actually introduced some of these changes, but I don't know if that rumor is true. So we have, clear evidence, I think, that there is smoke. We just don't know if there's fire, and we don't know anything else because it's disappeared into a black hole.
So, since you didn't explicitly mention Canadians, I feel much safer. Whatever. So since you said FIPS is bad, and since I work in the FIPS program, sometimes I do agree with you. But look at it this way. If we took FIPS away right now, it might be a worse state. Would it be maybe a good idea to take one of your grad students and analyze FIPS and come up with a really good thesis saying, how could FIPS be improved? We'd all love to read it.
So, that is something that I think is a really big research question and something that we're talking about. I mean, there are some really simple fixes. Just, run protocol tests against a device. Don't do algorithm tests. Don't look at paper. Actually test the device and see if it works. That wouldn't find all this stuff, but it would find some things that are not currently found by FIPS. There are a lot of improvements that you could make with very little overhead, and then there are a lot of improvements you could make with a huge amount of overhead, and the question is whether the community will do that, but definitely this is something that my grad students and I are thinking about.
So I'm having a little trouble wrapping my head around the malicious versus stupidity balance in the Juniper case. If Juniper was being malicious, why would it take them 3 years to figure out that someone had broken their hack? And has anything come out on that?
Nobody knows what happened there. It's weird. It's weird. It's really weird. There are a lot of unanswered questions. So we know that it was hacked. We assume that this was because some target, maybe a U.S. government target, was using these devices, and this hack was used in attacking them. We don't know who that was. It's possible that the way this was discovered was that somebody had built a backdoor, which was not very widely used but was used, and it stopped working. And we don't know the secret. We don't know the answer of how this came to be. But you're right. It was quite a period of time during which this vulnerability was not found.
Thank you. All right. I think I have a minute if there are any last questions. Okay. All right. I don't see anybody raising their hand or coming up to the microphone. So thank you once again. This was really eye-opening. Thank you. Okay, there were some additional announcements to be made, which I skipped because I wanted to get to the talk first. At the end of the day, there is an closing ceremony followed by a discussion on CC versus FIPS type of thing. And this was the most popular the subject that was chosen by the last year's attendees. So please do come and attend that. It should be interesting. Thank you very much, and see you in 20 minutes.